Amen.
Talking of good cooking, I think I got food poisoning last night. So I spent a decent amount of the night. Well, I won't tell you what I spent a decent amount of the night doing, but so I've been slightly hurried today. I wasn't really on my feet until this afternoon. So the notes are slightly rushed. So hopefully talking will sort of explain some of the gaps. If you've been with us so far, we should have hopefully gotten our heads by now that everybody knows God, but suppresses the truth of God. So non-Christians have got a sort of a mixed up brain, a sort of two brains, as it were. That I know God, but I don't know God. I can't get rid of him, but I serve an idol. So everyone knows God, but suppresses him. Everyone serves an idol at the same time. We saw the second week that idols have these messages they preach to us. It's not just that we randomly decide, oh, I'll swap God for Allah, or I'll swap God for, Vishnu, or I'll swap God for money or sex or whatever. We go to these other gods because we think they will bless us more than the real God will. We're self-interested people, and that's natural. Yeah, that's fine, basically. But we wrongly think the idol will provide for me in a better way than real God will. So the idol will provide real heaven, real joy, real pleasure. God can't. So idols have gospels, and those gospels make the same promises as God. So they promise us that if we just get money, or if we just worship Allah, then we'll be happy, then we'll be safe, then we'll be, live long and prosper. That's Mr. Spock, actually, isn't it? And then last week, we just started sort of picking apart the real gospel a bit more, in terms of how we experience the gospel, at least. And we looked at it in three directions, which were undoing the curse of Genesis 3. So in Genesis 3, when Adam and Eve are kicked out of the garden, they're separated from God, so they've got a problem with God. The world is cursed, so the world becomes a threat to them. Remember the thorns and the thistles, by the sweat of your brow. So the world is dangerous. And we lose our joy, our satisfaction. We're no longer fulfilled people, as we should have been if we were still living in paradise in relationship with God. And what God does in the gospel is he comes and undoes each of those problems, each of those curses. So he justifies us. He declares us not guilty, so we have peace with God. Justification is the Bible word for that. So we're put back into relationship with God, declared not guilty. We've got a clear conscience because of Christ. He adopts us. So he takes us to be his children. And if you have God as your father, and he's all-powerful and good, then actually the world's no longer a threat to you. You might die, you might get killed, but that's not a problem because he's all-powerful and good, and he'll just take you into heaven. So you get verses like Romans 8:28, in all things God works for the good of those who love him, or Matthew 7, where Jesus, talking about prayer, says that your father, which of you're evil, you know how to give good gifts. How much more does your father in heaven delight to give good gifts to those who ask him? And then makes the point that God, when we pray to him, doesn't give us, no, he does give us fish and bread. He doesn't give us snakes and stones. He gives good things to us because he's our heavenly father. He's good to us. So the world stops being an impossible threat to us because God's in control. He's adopted us. And we saw we're given new spiritual life. The Bible's word down there on the sheet is regeneration. Just the word posh for born again. Because we're given new life, we were dead spiritually, but we're brought to life. We can taste and see that the Lord is good. Or we can, Jesus' words again, come and feed on him as the bread of life, never thirsting or hungering again. There's an experience to it, as it were, a personal relationship with God that's all satisfying. So that's what should happen in the gospel. And of course we forget it and we drift from it. We stop feasting on Jesus and we go and feast on all sorts of other things. But that's what the gospel promises are, however strongly or weakly we grip onto them. Now, different parts of that gospel offer will naturally ring bells with different people. Okay, depending on what kind of non-Christian you are, basically, different gospel presentations, I suppose, will excite you, interest you, draw you in more quickly. And so there are loads of different ways to reach people with the gospel, to evangelise people. And I don't know how many years ago, some guys in Sydney came up with Two Ways to Live. Have you seen Two Ways to Live? Six boxes. You learn the sort of little gospel overview. 20 years ago, I don't know, 30 years ago. It's brilliant in that it teaches you a gospel overview, and it teaches you a sort of a simple way of remembering it. The only problem, so at uni we did courses learning the six boxes, and you draw out the little stick men. And you're always meant to do it on the back of a napkin. I've never done it on the back of a napkin in my life. The only problem with it is, which isn't really a problem with the course, it's just a problem with how people use it, is that we start thinking that is the only way I can ever evangelize someone. And unless basically I've sat them down, drawn a little guy under a crown, who then dies, and then a little guy who comes down and dies on a cross and all the rest of it, then I haven't explained the gospel. And again, as we touched on last week, I feel like I've not done any evangelism unless I've literally told people that they were made by God, that they're rebels deserving of hell, that Christ propitiated the wrath of God by his vicarious atonement, blah, blah, blah. It's just not true. If you read the Gospels and see how Jesus preaches the gospel to people, to the crowds, there's so many different ways he does it, in sort of pictures and images. Sometimes he's very clear, you know, he warns people to flee the wrath to come, or he warns about, you know, he talks about cutting your arm off, pulling your eye out so you don't go to hell. So there are those pictures. But also, he, as we've already mentioned, he sort of, I suppose, charms people in, tempts people in with pictures like the thirsting and drinking pictures. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. Now, as we're going to see, they're all reliant eventually on turning aside God's wrath. Unless we deal with the God problem, of course, nothing else can be sorted out. You can't have God as your father if he's still angry with you. Okay, so he's not going to take you to heaven if you and he are not in relationship. So it's not that you can split them up. It's just that in terms of how we present the gospel, there are loads of different ways. And we perhaps sometimes spend too long beating ourselves up that we haven't gone in with essentially the God-focused aspect of the gospel straight away. How do we deal with God's wrath and propitiation, basically? So just, I suppose, as a sort of first discussion to get you going, try and think through what kind of person, if you've got those three main gospel pictures that have been put right with God, with taking God as our Father so the world is no longer a threat because he'll protect us, and that of being brought to life spiritually so we can taste the pleasures of God. Try and think through which of those pictures, what kind of person would be attracted by each of those people? Which kind of person would each of those three pictures be most appropriate as a sort of route in to evangelising them? So that's the right with God, the adoption, the satisfaction picture. And then there's the paragraph there. It is, I suppose, a case study. So if you imagine a typical young single guy who just lives the weekends, drinks, sex, all he can get. Trying to be realistic about it, what kind of questions might you begin to ask him, do you think, that would just begin to open up opportunities to talk to him about the gospel? Okay, so questions to ask him. What kind of things might you, if you get to know him, begin to be able to point out to him about how the way he pursues his desires, essentially to be happy, to be satisfied, aren't quite going to work? So what kind of things might you be able to point out to him about how sort of sex, drugs, rock and roll isn't able to satisfy him? What are the problems with that idol, i.e.? Which of the gospel pictures is most likely to interest him initially? And if you do that, do it again, but this time with a mum who's maybe just had kids and is terrified about, you know, everything around her, what's going to happen to them, a sort of panicky person. Does that make sense? Okay, shout if any of them don't, and I'll try and explain more. Hopefully we've come to similar kind of answers, but let's just make sure we're on the same track. What kind of person is most likely to be interested in the fact that the gospel declares us not guilty or even right with God? What kind of non-Christian? Certainly somebody who feels guilty, so someone who's got a sort of very moral outlook on life. What kind of people do they typically end up being, normally? Religious, yeah. classic sort of Pharisee type person, brought up going to church. In terms of kind of people we come across, well, I don't know whether you come across them or not, to be honest, but in Derby, I mean, Muslims, hugely. Sorry? Normanton. Normanton and cricket, yeah. Huge sense of you've got to do the right thing by God, and there's no grace in Islam. So that's the idea of grace and forgiveness, justification, is just completely alien to them. So the idea that you can be certain that you and God are reconciled, that should be of interest to them. What kind of person would be most interested in the adoption picture? So the security, God as Father, kinds of people. Quite possibly, yeah. People who very literally don't have a good father figure or mother figure. Yep. Yep. Yeah, essentially people with sort of insecurity issues, whether about themselves or about the world around them, terrified of, I don't know, leaving home growing up or losing their job or anything that seems as a threat. And the last one, well, the last one is just the most common, I think, probably in our culture, in hedonistic culture, basically, people who are just desperately interested in finding pleasure and happiness and enjoying life, you know, live life to the full type people. And essentially, the first type of person is a religious culture, which is probably weakening in the UK, I guess. The second kind of person, certainly the sort of the more frightened person in some cultures, again around the world, where they're very much in terms of missionaries. This is one of the ways they go in. You know, the God who actually does control nature, the God who's actually sovereign overall. If you're living in a tribe in a jungle and you're very dependent for your survival on the world around you, then actually that's a sort of route in they take. And then again, in our culture, I think that last one. Just get over the page. Little question box on the next page. These aren't questions to answer, It's hard enough to get openings to try and explain the gospel to people. One of the ways that we can at least begin to get spiritual things on the map or on the agenda is just by asking questions. Partly it's humble. It's starting where they're at rather than just sort of firing in, trying to fire your bullets in when actually that you've not bothered to get to know the person at all. And also it's just I think it's just the it's a sort of human way of doing it. It's relational. As you make friends with people, this is not sort of street evangelism, but as you make friends with people, beginning to prod things like, are you really happy, honestly? Do you think it's going to last? What do you want out of life? Do you think there's a meaning to life? And even the more explicit things like, do you ever wonder if there's a God, or do you ever wonder if there's life after death? Letting them speak first is a less threatening, I suppose, that's what I'm getting at, a less threatening way into conversations that will hopefully be fruitful. Not an exhaustive list by any means, but just a few suggestions. What I'll do for the last sort of 15, 20 minutes or so is really to tie together two themes. It was possibly a bit ambitious when we started. We talked about both learning to engage the world in terms of evangelism, but also protect ourselves from becoming worldly. And for many people, there's a constant battle to have a quiet time each morning or evening or whenever you do it, to pray, to spend a bit of time with God. So we have our God time, and depending on how well we're doing, that might last 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour, an hour. You know, for most of us, it's a tiny fraction of the day. And so the volume of stuff that gets thrown at us during the day massively outweighs the amount of stuff we're getting from God directly. So these next two sections are trying to slightly deal with that a little bit. One of the things the Bible says is actually that God speaks to us everywhere all the time, not just through the Bible. Although the Bible is the fullest revelation and the clearest, and actually we can't understand anything else apart from looking through the Bible, everywhere and everything speaks to us. So Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, the sky above proclaims his handiwork, day to day pours out speech, night to night reveals knowledge. There's no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. If we were sinless and if we were thinking clearly, we would see, as it were, through everything to God. So you wouldn't just go for a walk in the park and think, pretty trees. You'd go for a walk in the park, think, pretty trees, and man, what kind of a God could make trees like that? He must be immensely imaginative or creative or whatever. Also, we wouldn't just look at our lives and see a sort of pointless sequence of events or a seemingly pointless sequence of events. We'd be able to, we'd see through our experiences, as it were, we'd see through the experiences again to God. We would see that God is teaching us in our day-to-day lives as we go along. Now, we don't do that, most of us. Mostly because we're sinful. And also, even when we become Christians, we become spiritually alive again. We're so out of the habit and we're so spiritually sleepy still, even though we're at least not dead, that we don't do it. But the fact that we're not listening doesn't mean he's not still speaking. So, in fact, God speaks to us constantly through all our experiences. So take good experiences. Good experiences in your life, pleasures if you like, should do two things. First of all, they're a little foretaste of heaven. So when you know you're particularly happy or particularly satisfied or relieved after a trauma or something, or you know, just paroxysms of laughter, or you're exhilarated, that is God graciously giving you a little foretaste of heaven. Okay, of the pleasures to come. And of course, it's just a small taste. It's like a starter at a banquet. Because at the moment, our capacity for enjoying pleasure is tiny. We're still this side of resurrection. But he's just beginning to show us how great it will be in the future. I feel like he's charming us, tempting us onwards to press on more and more towards heaven. And at the same time, it's also, these pleasures are a little glimpse of God. He's the source of all good things. He's the one who made them. So we both thank him for these pleasures and also try and think a bit, meditate on how they reveal him. So there's a C.S. Lewis quote, another than using one or two odd words. I think it's really helpful. Pleasures are shafts of glory as it strikes our sensibility, our senses. I've tried to make every pleasure into a channel of adoration. I don't mean simply by giving thanks for it. One must, of course, give thanks, but I mean something different. So far, he's got up to the first stage, that we say thanks to God, okay? Not just for meals, but thank you for everything. But he goes further. Gratitude, so thanks, exclaims very properly, how good of God to give me this. But adoration, worship, says, what must be the quality of that being whose far-off and momentary coruscations, I had to look that up, that means displays of his glory, apparently. According to dictionary.com anyway. So, translation into normal English. What must be the quality of that being whose far-off and momentary displays of his glory are like this? One's mind runs back up the sunbeam to the sun. If this is hedonism, pleasure, it is also a somewhat arduous discipline, but it is worth some labour. That's from an essay called Meditations in a Tool Shed, and he had this idea when he was working away in his shed. And you know when a beam of light comes down, and there's dust in the light, and he suddenly saw a beam of light, sort of, and that's what gave him the idea. And his point is that, yes, we say thanks for things, but we're meant to trace that pleasure back up to God. So we really enjoy, we get married, okay, and we really enjoy our relationship with our husband. But we shouldn't stop there. We thank God for a husband. We don't stop there, says C.S. Lewis. And he admits this is hard work, so it doesn't just happen naturally. We have to develop this habit. But when we have some particularly great experience, we meditate, we think about it. I can't remember what the word he uses is. One's mind runs back up. You'll think about it. And you think, well, what must God be like who can create a person like this? And you, it takes you up, and you think, well, God must be an even greater person. I'm enjoying this pleasure of relationship. But God himself is the one who created relationship. A relationship with him must be even greater. In fact, he himself is, being Father and Son and Spirit, he is a relationship of love. He's the source of all good things. So it's not going to happen naturally, but it's part of, spiritual disciplines to start being able to see through the world back to God, both in terms of thanks and also just how it displays a bit of his glory. Again, the walk in the park, and you come across an amazing view. You thank God for it, but it also makes you think, Lord, you must be a spectacularly imaginative, inventive, spectacular creator. It shows something about God. And the help, again, sort of C.S. Lewis, but the help there is that actually God is suddenly in all of life, not just in my quiet time or my church service. And all sorts of things, he speaks to us through all these sort of things. So rather than it being, let's be optimistic and say you have a half hour quiet time in the morning, rather than it being half an hour of God speaking to you and then 12 hours of the world speaking to you, it suddenly becomes 12 and a half hours of God speaking to you. Half an hour through the Bible, 12 hours through the world around you. Now, okay, you haven't got time to every second stop and analyse your sort of pleasure and all the rest of it. But you get the point. We see through the world around us, through our experiences, back to him. At the same time, not all life is good. So over the page, we have bad experiences. And bad experiences, again, do two things. They're a taste, obviously, I guess, of hell. And again, it's God being kind, not harsh to us, that he allows us to taste something of the horror of life without him. He's warning us effectively. So for now, we live at a time where we can take his gifts without him. Okay, you can be a non-Christian and you can take some of his gifts. So you can have a family, you can have friends, you can have, I don't know, money, security, all this sort of thing, without being a Christian. But in the future, it's not going to be possible. It's either God and the gifts or nothing in the future. So a lonely person is just beginning to experience a tiny fraction, a millionth of the loneliness that they will experience if they continue to reject God and end up in hell. In hell, you won't have any friends. That sort of tea towel about I'll be having such a good time with my mates that, you know, dot, 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 is not true. The depressed person, sort of incredibly sad person, whatever, is experiencing something of hell's emptiness, the horror of it. When we get ill, we're tasting a tiny portion of what it'd be like to live under the pain of God's wrath. And again, it's just a squillionth. He's very gracious. He holds back his hand. He doesn't reveal himself in his full wrath. But they're tasters. Now, if you're a Christian and you do those things, it's not that God's getting you or punishing you. You're a Christian. But he's reminding you of the horror of hell. And if you're not a Christian when you experience those negative emotions, that's what he's doing. He's basically frightening you. But if they're a taste of hell, they have to also be a taste of the cross. Because on the cross, Jesus went through hell for us. Those 3 hours, that's what he did. Went through hell on our behalf. So for those 3 hours, he was the loneliest or the sickest, the most pained man ever to have lived. And he did it so that we might not have to. Now, if you just flick to 2 Corinthians 8. This is basically what Paul's doing when he's trying to persuade the Corinthians to give generously. In fact, we'll do that verse in a sec. Let me just pause. So any questions on this thing about God speaking through our experiences? The good ones of heaven and of himself, the bad ones of hell and of the cross. Any questions so far before we go on?
I've just got a kind of feeling, which is difficult to explain. It's to do with the bad experiences. Mm-hmm. That people who, for instance, are lonely or depressed, yeah,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know whether you understand what I'm trying to
say. Yeah. No. Yeah. Okay, let me try and sort of clarify this a bit. I suppose what I'm saying is if someone is not a Christian, so let's take the loneliness one, and has rejected God, and is living for the sake of relationships, say. So they've pushed God away and they're saying, look, I want to live for romance. When it works, so when God gives them a boyfriend or a girlfriend or something, and they experience something of that joy of a relationship, that's the pleasure one, so they're getting a little taste there. When it doesn't work, and they're lonely and there doesn't seem to at least any sort of human experience of love there, then that's just a little foretaste there of what will happen if they die not Christian and end up in hell. That's what I'm saying. If you're a Christian, then because your sin's been punished in Christ, taken away as far as east is from the west, unfortunately, some of these things will still happen to you because you live in a cursed world, sadly.
And that's kind of what I'm saying, that sometimes Christians could feel, if they feel lonely, or if they feel depressed, that they're not being good enough Christians.
Yeah.
And that's a concern I've got, because obviously Christians do feel lonely at times, and they do feel depressed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wouldn't want anybody to think, well, because I'm a Christian, I shouldn't feel like this, or I should be able to get over it,
Yeah, no, that's. So take the illness one. I mean, I was vomiting away all last night. I mean, it's not because, I don't think it was because of, anything particularly sinful I'd done that day, other than eat Dave Clark's paella. But it's just a part of living under the curse, under the fall. No. You don't get the explanation yet. That most of the time on Earth you don't get the explanation, do you? Just occasionally, and I'm not even sure they're helpful, but just occasionally you read stories in books or testimonies or something, and something awful happens, and by the end of the story, so the awful happens in chapter 2. By chapter 30, they've worked out why, and it's all glorious and all the rest of it. I just think most of the time it doesn't happen like that. No, Job never gets told. And actually, most of the time, Christians, I'd have thought majority of the time, don't find out. Maybe we will in glory, I don't know. But it's not, God can speak to you in an experience. And I suppose, so again, let's take illness. If you're ill, it's not that he's punishing you, but he can still be speaking to you and showing you how awful that it would be, to have to suffer that forever. He's not blaming you or having a go at you, if you're a Christian, certainly. Any more on those things? Okay, let's just try and join the dots. So the idea is to try and move between our experiences or people's experiences and talking about Christ. The goal of the gospel is to present Christ crucified. So we can't just stop at presenting, saying to someone, look, you'd like to be happy, God will make you happy. Or you'd like to be safe and secure in the world, wouldn't you? God will do that for you. If we just do that, God just is a cosmic Father Christmas or Aladdin's genie or something, and that's just not the real gospel, is it? So somehow we've got to connect the dots. What we've seen hopefully is that every non-Christian who lives in the service of an idol gets to experience these little tastes of heaven and hell through their idolatrous gospel. They can't escape God completely. Okay, no non-Christian can escape God completely. They can suppress him, but they still live in his world, so he's still going to speak to them. He'll get through via different channels. What we're trying to say to a non-Christian, therefore, is that they live in a time at the moment when they're enjoying God's gifts, even though they haven't worshipped God, but that this won't last. So for now, he's being patient, you know, holding back his hand, holding back his wrath, and he's tempting them in, he's tempting them to Christ, and warning them not to ignore him. So it's carrot and stick, but both are gracious. Because if he wasn't gracious, he'd just come in glory now and destroy all sinners, and that would be that. So whether he's, you know, when you frighten your child about what will happen if he sticks his fingers in the socket, you're being kind to your child. It might be scary, but you're being kind to him. That's the same with God. When he frightens us, it's for our own good. When Jesus talks about Jesus speaks about hell more than anybody else in the Bible, and he's doing it out of love. He's trying to terrify us into heaven, away from hell. So, for the person, we've kept looking at these three types of people. For the person who's got a religious person, I suppose, sense of right and wrong, peace with God, you can say to them, look, in the gospel, you know, God is promising you that you can be forgiven entirely. So that experience that you know somewhat now, when you've done something good, or you feel righteous, or you've been praised for doing something right, that experience will be eternal. But also he's warning you that if you don't come to him, then you'll face eternity, an eternity of shame or guilt. But so much does he love you that he sent Christ into the world to become guilty in your place. So you're preaching the gospel in their terms. That's a fairly straight gospel, I suppose. Just jump down to the joy one at the bottom. Let's take someone who's typical non-Christian lad out for the weekend. So imagine the pleasure you get in sex, in drinking, in your nights out. Well, actually, at its best, your desire for pleasure is not a bad thing. Of course we want pleasure. We're made to be happy. And again, in a slightly distorted and twisted way, at his best, God is showing you how great life can be. But you're going about it the wrong way. You'll know from your own experience that there are times when you're not having any pleasure. Sunday morning after the Saturday night out, or when it all goes wrong. You'll know the awful times when you're not happy, you don't experience any pleasure. Well, that's God warning you. It's a little taste of hell. You can't keep joy forever if you keep rejecting God. But on the cross, so Philippians talks in these sort of terms, Christ gave up the endless joys of heaven to suffer agony in your place so that he can offer you an eternity of joy in God's presence. Psalm 16 talks about at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Essentially what you're doing is you're taking the gospel and using the language of the kind of things that they are into or that they believe at the moment. The 2 Corinthians passage, chapter 8, and the context is Paul trying to persuade the Corinthians to give money. Now, he could just say to them, look, you were filthy rebels, deserving of God's wrath. Christ bore God's anger in your place, so give generously. You know, he's won you back, give generously. But instead, he chooses language really carefully. So chapter 8 and verse 9. Trying to persuade Corinthians to give, he says this, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that through his poverty you might become rich. So he's trying to persuade them to break away from their idol of money and wealth. And so he uses their language. Christ was rich. Christ became poor. Ultimately, not just as a carpenter, but ultimately on the cross, he was completely destitute. He'd gone, everything taken from him. So that the Corinthians might become rich. And that's just one particular example of Paul doing this kind of stuff, trying to think of how to put the gospel into the language and the pictures, I suppose, that pagans, non-Christians, in this case even Christians, will understand. Okay, if you just turn to the very back page in the discussion, The three paragraphs are an example, so you can skip that. We'll finish with the discussion. What hopefully this allows us to do, if you can get your head around a bit, and it does take some thinking, as C.S. Lewis says, is be both offensive and affirming in how we do our evangelism. It's not just attack, 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 because there are promises. God charms us as well as warns us. Christ is described as full of grace and truth. And at times, with certain people and in certain ways he presents the gospel, it seems incredibly gentle. At other times, he is massively offensive. And it just depends who he's talking to and what the situation is. And so just try and work through. I think that you can do them in that order. Try and work through the first few questions. What happens if we're just affirming? What happens if we're just offensive? But that last question down there, to try and bring it back to culture stuff a bit. If God speaks to us through everything, and if we're meant to assess everything in the light of God's truth, can't remember what psalm it is, in your light we see light. So everything is to be seen through the Bible. Try and think through how you might react if you've just taken your kids or your wife or your partner or whatever to see a film at the cinema and it was a standard horror film. Probably not a very good parent if you've done that, but anyway. Standard horror film or a standard action film, just a bog standard plot, okay, or a chick flick. Try and think through how you might talk about it in the car on the way home, about sort of what kind of things the film might have done to you, and what kind of prayer you might pray to God, how that film might have revealed certain things to you, how God might speak to you through those films. What are the lies it's going to present? What are the truths? How does it give a glimpse of heaven? How does it possibly warn of hell? Okay, go for it. Again, shout if questions are confusing.